Thank you, Rob. And I'd like to thank the Australian Financial Review for the opportunity to speak to you today on a topic that many of us have found fascinating for most of our professional lives. And it's no surprise why. I mean, housing is a big deal. It's the biggest purchase most of us will make. It's an asset class worth almost $4 trillion, accounting for around 60% of household assets in Australia. Loans to buy property account for nearly 90% of all household debt and around 40% of the assets of Australian banks and other deposit takers. Now, housing prices have been rising quite quickly of late, and some people are asking whether they should be concerned about that. A number of factors have been boosting housing demand, and supply has struggled to keep pace. Developments in housing markets can be very important. Global experience, including most recent experience, suggests that they can have macroeconomic and financial stability consequences. And today I'd like to talk about some of those developments from both the macroeconomic and the financial stability perspectives. Next slide, please. Yes, I'm right. Sorry, I didn't have the thing. Housing prices in Australia have more than recovered the small decline of 2008. In the first 3 months of 2010, prices were growing quite smartly. In the major cities, they increased at an annual rate of between 12 and 15%, depending on the measure. Even adjusting for inflation, housing prices have risen by roughly 12% over the past year in the major cities, and by not much less in regional areas. The most likely short-term drivers of this sharp recovery and momentum in housing markets are, as usual, on the demand side. Government's policy was supporting first home buyers' capacity to pay. Interest rates were unusually low for a period, and unemployment did not rise as much as was earlier feared. Developments in housing finance have been somewhat at odds with this strength, though. Housing credit growth has been solid, but at 8.5% over the year to March, it's not running away. The number of new loan approvals for home purchase has been falling. In March, they were 16% lower than their peak late last year. One reason for this divergence might be that there's been a change in the kind of households in the market. More of the sales at the moment seem to be at the top end, where more properties are bought for cash. A more medium-term demand factor that has probably started to influence prices more recently is the population. For a long time, the number of dwellings in Australia grew faster than the population did. Now, this was necessary since average household size was on a trend decline, initially because families were having fewer children, and more recently because there are more single-person households as the population ages. But population growth has picked up a lot, starting around 2004, and it is now growing noticeably faster than growth in the dwelling stock. Together with these demand-side factors, the supply side is, of course, also important. The supply of housing is always going to be quite sluggish. Most of it is already there. The additional amount of new supply is inherently small relative to that stock. On top of that, the supply of additional housing in Australia does not seem to be that responsive. A number of factors are likely to be contributing to this. For example, it takes time to convert raw land to market-ready status. Many agencies have to coordinate their actions. And there are geographic limits to urban sprawl, especially since our major cities in Australia are all on coasts. But whatever the causes, the ability to add to supply is falling short of this higher rate of population growth, despite some pickup recently. Naturally, that is putting upward pressure on housing prices. This factor may be more prominent in this cycle than in earlier ones, when easier credit conditions and other factors probably played a bigger role in boosting many individual households' demand for housing. In the current episode, by contrast, more of the extra demand is likely taking the form of demand for more dwellings, precisely because of that extra population growth. Now look, the supply curve slopes up, and it always has. This is not something that can be wished away. We shouldn't think that more flexible supply would prevent prices from rising whenever demand increased. But because population growth is now higher, it would be desirable for the supply of new dwellings to become more flexible than it has been to date, and for a number of reasons. First, and most importantly, there's the simple fact that the extra people need somewhere to live. That is actually the core of the concerns about supply. Second, there is the issue of the relative cost of shelter. If the number of dwellings does not expand, more of the adjustment must come as a higher cost of housing, both prices and rents. Third, there is the issue of household finances. The more that housing prices rise, the more that some people might feel that they must stretch their finances to buy a home. And if household balance sheets were to become overstretched, household spending would become overly sensitive to income shocks. And such an outcome, if it occurred, would not be conducive to macroeconomic stability. A further concern is that if too much of the response to faster population growth comes as faster growth in housing prices, this could be built into people's expectations. If price expectations become over-optimistic and encourage too much investor demand, the result could be their disappointment, or worse. And again, such an outcome would not be conducive to macroeconomic stability. Even if household balance sheets were to become overstretched to some extent, though, historical experience suggests that this, on its own, is unlikely to pose significant risk to Australia's financial system. Of course, the state of household balance sheets could weigh on consumption and exacerbate the business cycle. Lenders' loan losses would then be higher in any future recession than they otherwise would be. But the loan losses themselves and the painful deleveraging have historically occurred primarily in the business sector and not directly in the household sector. In other words, taking a financial stability perspective, the state of household balance sheets and housing markets is not the most important issue for financial stability. And in the shorter term, housing is perhaps less important than it is from the perspective of macroeconomic management. Compared with other kinds of credit, lending to households to finance the purchase of housing is actually relatively low risk. International banking regulations recognise this by applying lower risk weights to home mortgages than to, for example, small business loans. And there are good reasons for this view. Historically, households have not normally been the instigators of financial instability. Aside from the very important exception of the current episode in the United States, financial crises are normally sparked by other sources. These include commercial property, property development, leveraged buyouts, sovereign debt, and so on. And as this graph shows, arrears rates on home mortgages usually only swing upwards significantly when unemployment has increased substantially. Now, the arrears numbers for Canada are much, much lower than the other countries, so the swing is harder to see, but the pattern is the same. What that means is that something else has to go wrong in the economy first, before one sees a big rise in home loan arrears and loan losses. Now, the exception to this pattern is, of course, the United States in the recent episode. There, arrears rates on home loans started to rise in 2006. That was more than a year before the unemployment rate did. As we noted in the most recent financial stability review released in March, Australian housing debt is higher relative to housing assets now than in the past. Now, we should expect this ratio to be higher than in the 1970s and 1980s. The financial regulation of that period artificially restricted household borrowing. For example, unmarried women found it hard to get mortgages back then. It's not a world I want to go back to. The question is whether this measure of leverage is higher than can be sustained. After all, it is much lower than in the United States, even before their boom-bust cycle. But we should expect that to be true. Because they can claim home mortgage interest against their tax, American owner-occupiers have less incentive to pay down their debt than their Australian counterparts. But these aggregated figures do not tell us much about the minority of households that pose the greatest risk. Undiscriminating use of aggregated statistics can in fact be quite misleading in financial stability analysis. We must also look at more disaggregated information, such as from household surveys. These provide many useful insights, even if they're not very timely. One source of disaggregated data in Australia is the Hilpler Survey, which has tracked a sample of Australian households for nearly a decade now. It asks homeowners how much they think the home is worth and how much debt they hold against it. From this information, we can calculate an estimated loan-to-valuation ratio for each homeowner. It's not a perfect measure, but it samples all homeowners, not just people who've recently taken out a new loan. And as this graph shows, by this measure, loan-to-valuation ratios have risen in recent years, but they are only back to the levels reported by households in the same age groups at the beginning of the decade. Now, this might at first seem at odds with the aggregate data I showed in the previous graph, with household debt expanding faster than assets. What has happened is that fewer people own their homes outright. Specifically, fewer households bought their homes without debt, especially amongst the over 55s age group. More households in this age group have mortgages now than in the past. Now, it's not clear if that's because they're not paying their original debt down as fast as they used to, or because they're not trading down as far as they used to. But either way, our assessment is that the increase in debt has broadly been concentrated in the hands of those generally more able to service it. If we focus on the group of households with debt that have high repayment burdens and high loan-to-valuation ratios, we can see that their numbers have risen over time. But the overall percentage has remained very low. This was true even in late 2008, the latest available data, when mortgage interest rates and thus repayments were at their peak. But if this relatively benign picture is to continue, one crucial precondition is that lending standards in the mortgage market have to remain prudent. Past experience has clearly shown that in the long run, you don't improve housing affordability by easing lending standards. That just gets capitalised into the price. In fact, easing mortgage lending standards too far can be outright damaging to long-run affordability. This has been amply demonstrated in the recent United States housing meltdown. There, the boom phase in the middle of the decade drew out a multitude of so-called affordability products. These were designed to help households purchase ever more expensive homes. They included subprime loans, of course, but also a plethora of no deposit, no documentation, teaser rate and negative amortisation loans that are just not seen in other countries. So households could borrow more, but this just helped to boost housing prices further. Now, during the boom, subprime lending was seen as a way of getting people into home ownership. But it had the added advantage that it could siphon some mortgage business away from the government-sponsored enterprises that dominated the US mortgage industry. It was therefore thought that subprime lending would reduce systemic risk in the mortgage market. But as millions of American households lose their homes to foreclosure, and the owner occupation rate declines to rates last seen in the mid-1990s, it would seem that they are worse off from this experiment. Subprime lenders could be seen as the cane toads of the US mortgage market. They were designed to battle one problem, but they ended up creating a much bigger one. Now, in Australia, lending standards never eased that far, and conditions never got that grim. Some newer data that APRA have been collecting can help shed light on mortgage lending standards here. As you can see, only a minority of recent home loan borrowers started with a loan-to-valuation ratio above 90%. The fraction of owner-occupiers with a high loan-to-valuation ratio at the beginning of their loan increased during the period when grants to first-home buyers were increased. These buyers normally have smaller deposits than existing homeowners who are moving, and they accounted for a larger share of new loans in that period. Now, we have been carefully watching lending standards in the first home buyer market segment. First home buyers have long faced greater risk than more established homeowners who have more equity in their home. But as far as the data allow us to tell, at any rate, recent new loans to first home buyers look quite like those made to previous cohorts of first home buyers. Indeed, across the mortgage market as a whole, lending standards are a little tighter than they were a couple of years ago. Banks and other deposit takers have gained market share relative to non-bank, non-deposit taker lenders that tended to offer less conservative mortgage products. And as the graph shows, the banks themselves now have a more conservative profile in their lending than previously. Some lenders have reduced the maximum loan-to-valuation ratio they will offer for certain customers. The fraction of new loans with low documentation is lower now than even 2 years ago, both for owner-occupiers and for investors. And although the share of interest-only owner-occupier loans has largely reversed its earlier dip, most of these are actually loans with offset accounts, which people use to pay their loan down faster, not slower. So to conclude, housing prices have been under upward pressure in Australia. The nature of the demand shock Australia faces means it would be helpful if more of that demand could be accommodated with extra homes for occupation instead of by higher prices. Some of that pickup in construction does seem to be happening. But even so, every cycle starts with something real, something fundamental. Recent data suggests that we do not currently have a credit-fuelled speculative boom on our hands. It would not be desirable for the current situation to turn into one. It will therefore be important for lenders to remain prudent in their standards. And it will be equally important for prospective borrowers to have realistic expectations and not to rely on a hoped-for capital gain in order to service their debts. Thank you.
Hi, Lucy. Kevin Young from the Investors Club. Between 1945 and 1970, the cash rate was about 3%, I believe, and the housing loan 5 to 5.5%. We had stable supply of housing, stable rent growth. Where do you see the future rates going with such a high rate and such a low construction?
Thanks very much for a very interesting question. I think that my first response would be, as I mentioned in my talk, comparing with the period of quite repressive financial regulation is probably not the right baseline to be using. As I said, you know, there were quite artificial restrictions on the availability of credit to good credits. There was quite substantial home building at that time. The actual rate of construction in Australia is not that dissimilar as a share of GDP. What's happened is that more of that has come in the form of renovation, and the average size of a house has increased, tracking the increase in the income that's occurred over that period. So, you know, nowadays, you know, some people will complain that certain people want, you know, very large, very fancy homes, but neither would it be appropriate to expect that, you know, a two-bedroom fibro is the appropriate starter home anymore when incomes have grown so much since that was the standard. I think there is, as I mentioned, there has been a coming together of the forces of extra demand, particularly coming from the extra population that we're seeing compared with a few years ago. That's putting more pressure on the need to build more dwellings as opposed to building nicer dwellings. And that's going to be putting some pressure up on housing prices. And the question is whether the interplay of that versus, you know, the cost and availability of finance, and when you get to the point that that's as far as people can continue to pay. And so the underlying question here is capacity to pay. The difference between what's happened in Australia over the last 10 years and what happened in the US cycle is that in the US, there were people borrowing amounts of money that they had no hope of repaying. And as long as the Consumer Credit Code in Australia and the various regulatory bodies involved in the process are doing their jobs and the lenders are lending prudently, you won't get to that position. So you can end up with a much more stable profile of borrowing, and therefore capacity, you know, because of the stable capacity to pay underneath. So, but I think the important point is that the, you know, the 45 to 1970 period is just not the right metric for comparison.
Hi, Lucy.
Michael McNamara from Heron Todd White. Lucy, to what extent do you think that the current taxation arrangements in Australia create massive distortions in the market? And can you give us some sort of insight as to whether you're a little bit disappointed that the recommendations put forward by the Henry Tax Review weren't taken up a little bit more seriously?
Okay. I think the first point to make is that I don't think there's an advanced country in the world that doesn't alter that, you know, that doesn't have a tax system that has some sort of advantage to housing. And at some level, you know, in the US, owner-occupiers can deduct home mortgage interest in a way that Australian households can't. And so, you know, we're actually on the owner-occupier side distorting less than some other countries, particularly the US. Where Australia is somewhat unusual is precisely what we identified in the 2003 product submission to the Productivity Commission inquiry. In Australia, the tax arrangements for small investors in rental property are somewhat more advantageous than in other comparable countries. That is, the scope for negative gearing is somewhat more more generous. Obviously, New Zealand's more generous still because it doesn't even have capital gains tax. But, you know, in Australia, the sort of whole process of negative gearing is somewhat more advantageous, and people can argue about whether that's a material difference relative to the kind of implicit tax subsidies that are in the US or not. But I think, you know, every country has some level of intervention in their housing market, and some of those can be conceived of as good, depending on your perspective. Some of them can be conceived of as bad.
Cautioning banks about lending in housing, where in Australia the tradition is you must repay the banks. A big housing loss is $25,000 for a bank, and the default rate's about 0.3%. And the Reserve Bank coming out last week, and in their opinion, I think it's a good comment, saying that housing prices in Australia have stabilised and they are unlikely to fall. How can we encourage the banks to go back to being a little bit more aggressive and lending to good first-home buyers?
Well, I don't think we actually said anywhere that we thought prices were going to fall. I don't think we've ever released a housing price forecast. There are certainly people who have that, but I just don't think the bank has made a public forecast of housing prices. Just to get to the substance of your question, I think with my financial stability perspective on, I think actually aggressively lending to anybody is never words that a financial stability specialist or a prudential regulator really wants to hear. I'd like to hear about lenders being prudently flexible, but I would like them to be making smart decisions about who are good credit risks and who are not so good credit risks, thinking intelligently about lending standards, and not just about LVR and, you know, the old metrics of loan to income. I want them to be thinking about, how do they know what they know? What are their loan documentation standards? What's the basis for the valuation that they're even using? Is it just the market price? How sustainable is that? Are they, you know, just getting someone to do a drive-by and a Google Maps just to make sure the house is there, or are they actually... I actually refinanced just recently and it was a Google Maps. So it's just not clear to me that you want to be encouraging people to lend to anybody. You know, if you can fog a mirror, you get a loan. I mean, that's what went wrong in the US, is that if you could fog a mirror, you could get a loan. They didn't really care if the house was there. They didn't really care if you said who you were, how much you earned. You just get a loan, package it up, securitize it off, and away we go, pocket the fee. And that's the sort of mentality that I think regulators in any other country would not want to see. I think, you know, obviously there are a lot of people here who want to ensure that first home buyers can access finance and can find a home that's appropriate to them. But the last thing you want to do, you're not doing anybody any favours by pushing them into a loan they can't reasonably service and in a house that they can't reasonably afford. And that really is the lesson of the United States over the last few years.
Who else would like to ask a question? I didn't hear the word bubble. I hear the term bubble all the time when I write real estate. I didn't hear you say bubble at all. Does that mean Reserve Bank thinks bubble talk is baloney?
We think the bubbles are possible. We think that they have happened in some markets at some times. But yes, I did explicitly not use that word. You might recall that this invitation was originally to the governor, and he's actually overseas, so I'm here instead. He just got me. Sorry.
We're delighted, Lucy.
Yeah, and but yeah, I mean that's as I, you know, I can just quote back in one of the last lines. Recent data suggests that we do not have a credit fueled speculative boom on our hands at this point.
Matthew Bell, IPM. Even though there's no mechanism for, you know, a bubble popping or a big price fall, is that the same? Does the ABA see the? I mean, there's a lot of looking at price to income ratios, you know, across different countries. A lot of people say that we're expensive because of that. Is that the same as saying that the RBA doesn't see the Australian housing market as historically overvalued, or are those international comparisons not valid in your view?
Well, as I said in my speech, undiscriminating use of aggregated statistics can be very misleading. There's certainly commentary out there that just says, you know, price-to-income ratio, forgetting all those points about disinflation and deregulation and what that does to an equilibrium debt income ratio, and we've been talking about that for over a decade. Glenn did a speech back in 97 or 98 on that, and there's been a number of other papers that we've written on that particular topic. You know, I don't think we're in the business of talking about how, you know, what is the equilibrium house price to income ratio, but comparing to the 1970s and 80s of your own history or an undiscriminating comparison to other countries can be quite misleading. A lot of the data is not as comparable as people make out. I know some of my counterparts in various other agencies have made some bloopers in terms of, you know, what's in their debt level or what's in their price numbers. Is it detached houses? Is it houses plus apartments? Is it just the major cities? Is it all of the cities? I mean, remember, in Australia, 55% of the urban population is in two big cities. You know, the equivalent figure for the US is about 3 or 4% of the population, of the urban population. And so you've just got this composition effect. Big cities are inherently more expensive, even relative to income. There's lots of economic theory about that. And so it's not necessarily the case that you can say, oh, well, this country's got that ratio and that country's got that ratio, therefore that country is overvalued. One of the reasons why there's not sort of, you know, just me sitting up there on the Financial Stability Department, and I have a whole team, is that, you know, we need to think a bit smarter about it than just looking at those aggregated statistics and thinking about what the real underlying drivers are.
The other side of the finance question looking forward is the fact that the development industry in recent times has found it very difficult to receive access to finance in order to go forward on building, especially in the apartment side. And I'd be really curious to know your views on how you see that as an impact on supply going forward, especially in the fact that we are sort of hearing between the banks and APRA that there is a significant tightening, an ongoing tightening that will be occurring in the finance sector.
Mm. Thanks for the question. And it sort of ties in with one of the points I made in the talk, which is that, you know, generally something else goes wrong rather than on the household balance sheets. And one of the things that's actually been a clear lesson from the recent downturn around the world is that commercial property, and particularly property development, is an industry where the risks are highly concentrated, the defaults are very bunched. And so there is this dilemma. You know, on the one hand, people want there to be finance available to build the apartments in particular. I mean, this is something that's very much about the high and medium density developments. You know, they want that finance there so that the supply can get in there. But at the same time, we know that objectively these are the credits that become most liable to default during downturns. And so that's precisely what we've seen and what we've documented in the Financial Stability Review, is that it's, you know, the arrears rates on home loans went up a little bit during this period, but where the real concentrated exposures were partly in sort of commercial property proper, but property development as well, including development of residential estates, so high and medium density, has been an area where the risks to the lenders have objectively increased. And so there is this sort of dilemma of making sure that there's enough finance, but making sure that genuinely you're still lending prudently. And I acknowledge that that is something of a dilemma across the policy question.